This is Talk Is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. I'm your host, DJ Susti. The reason radio is not dead is because one of the things we do is we try to narrow down for you what is available on the giant internet. The next few weeks, we'll be doing the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference from 2022. Notice that there's only like 12 downloads or 12 listens to the YouTube channel. So I'm editing these down. All I'm taking out is the Zoom meeting glitches, because it's all done on Zoom meetings, and the housekeeping stuff that they do at the beginning. So they're all about 50 minutes. So you won't hear much of an intro, and you will you won't hear much from me, which may or may not be good for you. And maybe you're tired of my theme song, so there won't be much of that. For the next few weeks will be the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference of 2022, also available on YouTube. But this week is Lois Arkin. She describes how she started the Eco Village. It kind of pertains to what's going on right now, because it's the solution. What I try to bring you, the reason it's called Talk Is Cheap, is because I try to bring you solutions. And she has the solutions. What's going to happen is you're going to see a lot of higher prices. This is actually what we want to happen. It's the beginning dying gasps of globalization. So you're going to see high prices and you're going to see high oil prices, but we want high oil prices so that we can go move to an alternative. And we want high prices because that's the true cost of things without exploiting labor and the environment. And you're seeing the end of the petrodollar that is used to finance war and extract wealth from countries and loot treasuries. People are sick of it, and it's the end of the petrodollar. So that's what you're seeing also. And so the way to beat that, the way to deal with that, is to get with your neighbor and start a co-op and start growing your own food and localizing, and being self-sufficient. And keep pushing for health care, for an insurance pool. That would be called, some would call socialized medicine. I call it a health insurance pool. Transportation, mass transportation, we need. And, you know, child care and free education. That's what we got to keep pushing for. That's what we got to keep the eye on the ball, and no more war, of course. Get with your mutual aid. I just got a notice from Wisconsin Mutual Aid. They're taking off and networking with other mutual aid societies around the country. We have one in Eugene here. And Cooperation Eugene and the Neighborhood Anarchist Collective. And one thing I just wanted to say is socialism is when the government owns the means of production. Communism is when the workers own the means of production. Co-ops are when you and your neighbors and the other people that use the goods and services own the means of production for the same goods and services. Like I say, coming up over the next possibly 8 weeks, I've got four in the can right now, is the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference. This year, they're having a lot of solutions and a lot of success. And they've learned some tactics, so it's very positive. They might be a bit boring, some of them, but they're all empowering and they're all encouraging. Okay, so one thing I've noticed that just a little bit of minor observation and humor here, this is strictly me, my own speculations, but I noticed Biden and Trump both kind of cringe. It reminds me of Montgomery Burns and Mr. Smithers, how Montgomery Burns comes up with these wacky plans that just exploit people and that are never going to work, and they know they're not going to work. Smithers, his groveling assistant, tries to tell him that it's not going to work, and of course it doesn't work, and it blows up in Montgomery Burns' face. So both Trump, it's maybe my own observation, but it seems to me they're kind of cringing. And, you know, Joe Biden is, I call him the Delaware Joe, because he's from Delaware, where corporations go to spawn. And even he knows, you can tell when he's talking, that he knows this is not going to work and that he's tried to tell him that it's not going to work. But he just has to do what his corporate oligarchs, masters, tell him. And Trump, too, you know, has the Koch brothers. I can just see a meeting with the Koch brothers and Trump saying yes sir, no sir to the Koch brothers and trying to tell them that it's not, even he doesn't think it's going to work, but they're so extreme. So that's what you're seeing right now is we've all told them, we've told them for 20 years. I've studied this stuff. I'm no expert, but I've studied this stuff literally since I was 10 years old, when I can remember the gas crisis. Corporations got on my radar back then in the 70s, and then there was the WTO in 1999. We've been trying to tell them that it's not going to work. Why would you ship something? How could it possibly be cheaper to ship something across the Pacific Ocean than it is to make it yourself, except culture and art? Okay, coming up next this week is Lois Arkin, recorded at the LA Eco Village by the LA Eco Village, and uploaded to YouTube, as uploaded to YouTube. And then the next few weeks will be Pilk 2022.
Well, LA Eco Village on the ground in this location was established in January 1st, 1993. After about 10 years of planning, much of that time planning for another site about 7 miles from here, that was an old city-owned landfill on 11 acres. And it seemed very rural, even though it was still very very much part of the city. And so we used that site. It was quite amazing and wonderful because we were able to use that site. We have a fabulous volunteer architect put together a 50-page feasibility study, a three-dimensional plan for the, you know, sculpture, forgot what you call those things, for the site. And we had done a lot of advocacy in City Hall and actually got the idea of the Eco Village written into the city's housing element, which is part of the general plan for the city. It said, yes, there will be, and we didn't have the word Eco Village then. There will be a solar ecological village, and it will be supported by the mayor's office and the community redevelopment agency and the environmental affairs department and so forth. It was actually written in as public policy. So we were very proud. Thought, oh wow, you know, we've arrived, we're public policy. And of course, anyone that's done public advocacy work knows that as long as you're fairly well organized, articulate, and find yourself in the right place at the right time with the right people, getting public policy is not all that hard. Getting a regulation is a bit harder, and getting funding is even a bit harder, and getting accountability for that funding is harder still. So we only went the first step on that sort of thing. Now, why did we do it? Why were we wanting to create something called an ecological solar village before there was the word eco-village, or even before the word sustainability came into common use, which was not until 1989, and we started working on this site about around the mid-80s. My organization, CRSP, standing for Cooperative Resources and Services Project, as its public interest purpose, is a training and education center for the development of cooperatives of all kinds. And so therefore, goodness gracious, here in Los Angeles, the great 435 square mile city of Los Angeles, we have spread throughout that area back in the 60s, 70s, 80s. We had worker co-ops here, food co-ops over there. We had childcare co-ops over here, housing co-ops over there. We had co-ops spread throughout the city. Not all that prolific, but I knew about them when I started this organization in 1980. And why don't we have a cooperative neighborhood where all of the co-op activity comes together in a geographically bound, walkable area. So that was the idea for why start a sustainable neighborhood or an eco-village or an ecological urban village. That was what it was that we were aiming for even then, and found that site after scouting the central city for quite a while, and found that we could work with that site, even though in my we were very naive. It was not a good site for an eco village, but it was a good site for bringing people together, doing planning, learning a lot, getting public policy in place, meeting a lot of people throughout the city, and in the various city departments that we would have to work with. So it served its purpose well. It wasn't until after the 1992 riots or civil unrest that Los Angeles went up in flames as a result of the Rodney King decision not to hold the Los Angeles police officers responsible who had brutally beaten Rodney King. And that was essentially the first time that something like that had been videoed and gone viral. And of course, since that time, we know that we haven't come near solving that problem. That's a whole other issue. But it was those fires throughout this section of Los Angeles and south of us and west of us, where there were fires all over the city, and where we are in this building right now, adjacent to us, there was a two-story commercial structure that burned to the ground, just, you know, kind of smoldered for 3 days. There was a print shop, a photo development lab, and a dry cleaners. And I know I lived across the street at the time, but I know I never breathed the same. But there were five significant fires within two blocks of where we're sitting right now. And so that weekend, people were either leaving the city in droves or planning to, or coming into the city to help sweep up and clean up. And what I did is I sat at my computer for 2 days, translating the 50-page feasibility study into 4 pages of bullet points about how could we do this $50 million new construction eco-village that we were planning on this 11-acre site. How could we translate that into the retrofit of a built-out, urban, intensely urban neighborhood? In such a way that maybe things like that might not happen again if we could demonstrate a different way of living in our city. And that became our vision, to reinvent how we live in the city. And so Monday, our 20-member planning group came together, and for the next 6 months, from the uprisings were in April 1992, so from April, May until December, we were talking about that at our meetings. At every meeting, we continued to kind of work on the 11-acre site 7 miles from here, but not with a lot of enthusiasm. And there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm in that neighborhood for having us be there. And so on December 11th, 1992, it was enthusiastic and it was unanimous. Oh, let's just do it in Lois's neighborhood. Because, as I said, there were five fires here. I had already lived in the neighborhood for 13 years and been holding all kinds of community events and workshops in my very small space here in the neighborhood. And so let's just do it where we have already some kind of a presence. Because what was critically important to me and to many members of that planning committee is that we have to live in the neighborhood where we want this sort of thing to happen. So we can't kind of go live 20 or 30 miles away and drive into a place that you want to make an eco-village every day. You got to live there. You got to be with the people, and especially if it's going to be an urban eco-village, and especially even more so if it's going to be in an intensely urban area, which we are. And so it was an easy decision. I was very grateful that that's what our planning committee wanted to do. I didn't have any commitment to this neighborhood, even though I'd lived here for 13 years. And on January 1st, 1993, I made that commitment. And here we are now. Mm-hmm. a long time, 26 years later. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you asked the question.
Yeah, no, that's great.
Why did we get started?
And you said earlier that there was a lot of, you know, the lead up to actually owning these buildings and having people live in them, that there was a lot of community engagement work that you did kind of in the lead up to that. Can you describe that process a little bit more?
Well, it's interesting because of the 20-person planning committee that were essentially members of the organization CRISP. And, you know, just were good friends of the organization. I just always kind of assumed that several people on the planning committee would want to live in the thing we were planning. And wake up call, no one did. So at any rate, for the first few years, I was the only person who lived here intentionally. And several members of that planning committee would come in 2 and 3 times a week, and we would walk the neighborhood up and down the streets, meeting people. Mostly it was a scary neighborhood, and people didn't spend a lot of time on the streets. However, we would sometimes, you know, start being playful in the streets. Parents were not too excited about letting their children outside alone. Finally, we decided within a few months, by Earth Day, April 1993, we were already planning a tree planting. So, for example, we would meet parents of children and ask them if it was okay if we had their children come to a little brunch on the sidewalk to talk about what kind of fruit trees we could plant. So we had about 12 kids come to little brunch on the street and ask them what kind of fruit tree they would like to plant. And so on Earth Day 1993, we did that. We planted 4 fruit trees, and the kids, we named them as tree stewards. The kids got to name their tree, and we would do a little ritual around the tree when it was in the ground. They would dig the hole the week before, and with some help, and then we'd get the tree in the ground. Then we'd make a circle, and we'd talk about what are going to be the problems this tree is going to have, and how are you going to help it. And they had little plaques with their tree's name on it, and who was the tree steward. So it was really exciting, and then that was kind of the start of something really important. The other thing we had been doing leading up to the April tree planting, when we started walking up and down the block in January, as we'd meet neighbors in a very friendly demeanor, we would introduce ourselves and say what some of our visions were for the neighborhood, and try to learn as much as we could about the neighbors we were meeting on the street. And then when we met other neighbors, we would gossip about the other neighbors we had met, but only positive gossip. And then we would kind of have neighborhood events and flyer the whole neighborhood and tell everyone, come on, bring some food, let's get together as a neighborhood. And then we would introduce them to one another and with great excitement. Oh, this is the person I was telling you about, that blah, blah, blah. And so they would be really enthusiastic about meeting each other. And in 6 months' time, actually in the first time we had a meeting, invited neighbors, and there were not too many that came, of course, only a handful. And then when we asked, what do you think were the strengths and weaknesses of our neighborhood, we never got beyond the first one, which all anyone wanted to talk about was crime, the big C, so to speak. So if we were kind of a conventional community organization, we would immediately have started to organize a neighborhood watch group. But we clearly understood that the fear of crime is much more debilitating than crime itself. And so we and what we also knew was that oftentimes it's the breakdown of community that creates that kind of fear. So we just figured we should be working on developing community rather than developing a neighborhood watch. Who wants to have a neighborhood watch where the only thing that neighbors talk about is who broke into whose home or whose car or who stole what? Or, you know, stuff like that we didn't think was going to be the best thing for creating community, but essentially creating more fear, and that that would be the thing that people organized about. It didn't really resonate with us. So we just continued to do our community relationship work. 6 months later, we had a similar meeting and asked the same question. And crime came on the third page of our brainstorm list, and it came as an afterthought. Oh yeah, we still have to think about crime. And the reason I like to stress that when we do our tours and here talking to you is because that was something we accomplished with essentially zero money and only time and a desire to be friends with our neighbors. It's quite amazing how much you can accomplish and essentially change the culture of a place in so short a time with so few resources. So that's how that happened. And then that went on for the next 3 years until we bought our first building. And we continued to have volunteers that came out frequently. We were planting trees, we were planting little gardens around the trees. Parents were saying, my kids never eat the vegetables from the grocery store, but they can't wait to eat these vegetables. When can we get a vegetable garden for another neighbor that hadn't yet had one? And so that was very gratifying. And then we continued to have a lot more spontaneous activity in the neighborhood with the kids. We went on bicycle field trips. We even went on weekend camping trips with their families. And so all of our, essentially our community work was in our community, not community development, because that hints of that's like community economic development. And in our case, we're thinking of community development as the development of community. And so that work went on for 3 years. And of the 500 people that lived in our neighborhood, we pretty much knew all of the children, what buildings they lived in, who their parents were. And there was just a whole different feeling on the street. And we really did become a neighborhood that was very much a community. It was a wonderful, wonderful time in the development of Eco Village. On the other hand, what we all know is that on average, Americans move once every 5 years. And so those people with whom we formed so many wonderful relationships, there's hardly not any of them left here anymore. And as new people moved into the neighborhood, we had already begun to grow inward, because we had bought this 40-unit apartment building that was in near slum-like conditions. The first time we had a building inspection, we had 200 violations, habitability issues. The apartment building was half vacant, and so we had never owned property before, or managed it for that matter. So that inward, getting more and more inward to make what we had habitable, and at the same time trying to make good decisions about who we would allow to move in that could be members of our intentional community. By that time, we actually did have, I think, three or four more neighbors who had moved into other vacant units on the block, but not in our big building that we had just bought. So we were pretty inwardly focused, and that wonderful, wonderful era of the beginnings of Eco Village kind of grew behind us. And now, 26 years later, we hear a lot of our intentional neighbors wanting very much and acting on their desires to do much more outreach in our existing neighborhood. And many of our neighbors here have become friends with other neighbors in the neighborhood that are not members of our intentional community. So that is beginning to happen once again. On the other hand, I don't think there are nearly as many children in the neighborhood today as there were 25 years ago. But we now have children of our own that we're dealing with, but we're not seeing the integration of the children in our intentional community with any of the children in the two-block neighborhood that we call the Los Angeles Eco Village neighborhood.
You already started getting to stuff that I was going to ask about next, which is kind of, you know, 26 years later, mm-hmm. how do you feel like LA Eco Village has manifested, you know, or continues to manifest the sort of original intention of it? And how is it maybe diverged, or what are the challenges to manifesting that vision?
Well, what has been manifested, and quite well, is it was our plan to have a limited equity housing cooperative. It was our plan to have a community land trust and to separate the ownership of the housing from the ownership of the land. And the reason that we wanted to do that was a hard lesson that I brought with me from this city, because what I knew heading up the Co-op Resource Center, as we call CRISP, is that in the 1940s and 50s, there were some limited equity housing co-ops that had public subsidies. And when those mortgages that were subsidized out of Washington, when those mortgages were paid off, and the people who owned those buildings realized that our building is worth, you know, lots more money than what we paid for our shares, and they sold, and they were then free to sell their buildings and go off in their many separate ways. And so I didn't want that to happen. So how could I protect what we were starting out? How could I protect that? And so the European model for development after World War II was also something similar, with what they called mutual housing associations. And the idea of separating the housing ownership from the land ownership, and then having really tight documents in the articles of incorporation, in the bylaws, in the policies, that would be several more layers of protection to prevent that from happening. But what I also know is that no matter how good your documents were at protecting those kinds of things, the ultimate protection is the culture you build. And that is what took a bit longer than we anticipated. So having bought this building, the one that we're in now, in 1996, CRISP bought it, the development organization. We did not sell it to our resident co-op until 2012, because it took that long to build the culture that my board felt secure, that overall people understood, we are not doing this just for ourselves, affordable housing, but for future generations as well. And we wanted everyone to kind of really get that and not have the threat of what happened to that affordable housing from the 40s and 50s and even the 60s. So that is that's one thing that happened, but I forgot the question I was answering, which
How has it continued and what have been the challenges?
So we did very well in having a limited equity housing co-op, having a community land trust. We also have a local currency. The original local currency was the local exchange trading system, or LETS, which is happening in different parts of the world quite successfully. And that kind of had a good 10-year life, and then that kind of petered out. And for the last 10 years or so now, we've had the Time Bank. And so that's a very good local currency. It was important to have a local currency, and we have one. But we have a lot of informal exchange of goods and services as well within the intentional community. I would say one of the really, really the backbone of everything was our ecological revolving loan fund, because when we first bought this building, we assumed, like other nonprofit housing developers, we would jigsaw puzzle money from a lot of different places, like foundation loans and grants, foundations, city money, state money, federal money, other institutional money, and we even applied for some of those monies, and there were organizations that really did want to loan us money. However, there were hoops to go through, hoops that would have destroyed the character of this building. And we just decided, in the mid-1980s, we had wanted to experiment with a number of different kinds of economic systems, and one of them was the LET system, our local exchange trading system. And the other one was, oh, let's start a revolving loan fund. And at that time we thought, oh, this will be a revolving loan fund for any small green co-op oriented businesses. And we would put it out there in our hard copy newsletter that went out to 5,000 people. We have money to loan. Does anyone want to start a small green co-op? And every once in a while we'd get a little bite on that, and someone would come and say, oh, Lois, we want to start a co-op. And I would say, well, find at least two or three other people that want to do what you want to do, and then start meeting. And every time you meet, have everyone put in a little money, keep track of how much who is putting in. And then during this period for the next 6 months, do your business plan, and I can help you with that or get help for you. And then after 6 months, to come back, let's see about a loan. Do you think anyone ever came back? Zero. That was the most wonderful lesson that I ever had. Oh, wow, there's always going to be money out there. All you have to do is have a really good vision, clear vision, have a good plan, be flexible, stay grounded, and persevere, and money will happen. And so it is that it would. So finally, what we realized, because we started that loan fund in mid-1980s, and we had as much as $20,000 in it from time to time, because people would loan us money. We would invest it in some socially responsible mutual fund. At that time, it was Working Assets, as many of you out there will know. And then we'd get interest on that money, and we would pass it through to the lenders. And if they wanted their money back, we would give it back to them, because we were just holding it for them to see that, oh, we knew how to operate an ecological revolving loan fund. And so then at a certain point, when we were thinking about, oh, we're gonna need a lot of money to buy this building, and we had decided we were not going to pay a penny more than $500,000 for this building in 1996, because it was in such slum-like conditions. And it was kind of still when the real estate market was very, very low. But the building had a $1.2 million note on it, but it was on its way to default because they hadn't been paying on the mortgage. And so we just said, let's just, we'll have to buying $500,000. And so at a certain point, we just started growing our loan fund and reaching out to everyone we knew that might have money to loan to our loan fund. And we created a 25-page plan for what we were going to use them, you know, kind of what they, what did they call it, that a prospectus, yeah, something like that, where the money was going to come from, how we were going to use it, how we were going to pay it back. I just borrowed someone else's plan and then adapted it to our situation. It was very simple. A lot of people are just, oh, you know, when we say that's what you need to do if you want to start a small business and get a loan or something, oh, where would, you know, borrow someone who's already done it successfully and adapt it to your situation. So that's what we did. And then we sent it out and to everyone that we thought maybe would have some money to loan, and sure enough, they did. And we had very simple loan agreements. At one point, we had a 6-page loan agreement, which I wrote myself. And then someone loaned us money. Someone wanted to loan us $100,000, and they did not like our loan agreement, so they cut it down to a 1/2 page. So that's what we've been using ever since. And anyone can find that loan, a sample loan agreement, and what our loan fund is all about, because we're still using it, on our website, laecovillage.org. Pull down the crisp menu and you will see the information sheet on the loan fund and the sample loan agreement. And everyone is encouraged to use that way of bypassing banks and all that other kind of ways of getting money where you don't know where the money is coming from, where it's going to, floating all over the world, doing who knows what to who knows who. So this is something we encourage people to loan to our loan funds, and there are other similar loan funds within the FIC network and the EcoVillage network. And the idea is that you know where your money is and what it's doing, and you can come visit it. So we encourage that kind of grassroots loaning. So someone told me recently, oh, you were doing crowdfunding before that was crowdfunding.
Right.
Something
right.
Like that.
Say a little bit about the food lobby and how that got started and what its role is.
Well, the food lobby, you know, there are many, many different kinds of activities here. We have a food co-op we call the food lobby because guess where it started? In the lobby of our big building. We have a tool shop that anyone can use. We have, there are many, many bicycle activities that started here in LA EcoVillage, which has been the center of bicycle culture in our city. So for example, the first bicycle kitchen, self-help bicycle repair started here. Now it's spread. There are bicycle pantries, bicycle ovens, and so forth around the city, around the country. We have an art studio, a sewing studio, and take you to show you these. But the food lobby started with one of our, one of our interns about, 10, 15 years ago. And that was something that we all kind of went along with. And eventually, at first it was just the produce boxes that we had made arrangements with one of the farmers at our Sunday farmers market to come deliver produce to us after the market closed down on Sundays. And then we would tell people, not only people who lived here, but other people within our larger constituency. And they would put it $10, I don't think that's ever changed. It was always $10 from the time we started it 10, 12, 15 years ago. And eventually, when the bicycle kitchen moved out of the kitchen in our bike room, which is how the bicycle kitchen got named, because that's where it started, then that room became the location for our bulk room. So anything you would find in a natural food store, if you can't find it in our very, very small bulk room, you can put in your own special order and our a wholesaler will deliver a box with your name on it once a month when they come to refill our our bulk room orders. So that's how that all started. And now there are 60 members, not all of them active all the time, but we generally have about anywhere from 10 to 15 produce boxes every week from the farmer. And then we probably have, you know, probably 15 or 20, 25 people that shop in the bulk room every week. The hours are very limited, but we are, there's talk now of expanding the bulk room both within our big building where we are right now and the potential of moving it into a public, a more public place in the new property that we're working on for the past few years, adjacent on the north end of Eco Village, on the north end of the Eco Village neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So where do you see LA Eco Village going?
Oh, well, ta-da. we have a 25-year plan, which I can send you a copy of. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, my organization, which is the initial developer of the LA Eco Village neighborhood, CRSP, CRISP, has a 25-year plan. So some of the aspects of that plan are that are immediately in front of us is the redevelopment of the quarter-acre site immediately north of our large building in the north end of LA Eco Village, an old auto repair shop and an old cafe. So we're in the process of redeveloping that site for the past year or two, and probably for another year or two before it's particularly operational. But the vision for that site is to create an eco co-op hostel where groups of people will come to stay, will stay in the hostel. Groups of people, academic groups, faith-based groups, neighborhood council groups, and other kinds of civic organizations where people can come in groups where they already know each other or live close together to each other and have an immersion experience in urban sustainable living. We'll have terrific programming. We have lots of knowledge and skills here in LA Eco Village and colleagues and friends here in the city that are involved in that sort of thing. And also it will have several small businesses in that space, and it will have a cafe, it will have a mini public transportation museum in an old streetcar that we're going to bring back on the old streetcar tracks that are still publicly visible here in the neighborhood. So that's at the north end of the block. We have a dead-end street here in the middle of Eco Village, you know, around the intersection, and it goes east for about 800 linear feet. So another vision at this point, I'm hoping that it will turn into a plan this year, is to take the parking lane and the sidewalk. There's nothing on the north end other than a parking lot that belongs to the school district. And so to take about 15 feet coming out from the sidewalk and the parking lane and 800 linear feet and creating a small urban farm that will employ a few people and we'll be able to obviously have all that produce for our co-op, for our cafe, and for our neighborhood. So to have an urban farm there, possibly with a tiny house on the corner that would have people that live there, that would be an information kiosk and security and members of our community. Then we have a row of fourplexes on our dead end street. There are six fourplexes. Our land trust owns one of them. And our vision is eventually to buy all of the fourplexes on the block. But between the fourplexes and the garages behind them, I can see a pathway from our main north-south street all the way east, a pathway between the fourplexes and the garages on their garages. And all of those garages would turn into small business spaces with this wonderful little walk street between them, kind of European style, or style of almost any country that's not America, where there are these tiny little beautiful intriguing walk streets. So that's another concept. Also to make a plot to make our main north-south street and our east-west dead-end street essentially car-free, or at a minimum car-light. So that would be something that is very, very important to us. And then actually be able to have the entire block be essentially a promenade or plaza. Meantime, we have an alleyway that's next to our 8-unit building, adjacent to our 40-unit building, and to turn that alleyway into a promenade. And that currently it's an easement that's owned by our land trust and the strip mall next behind us. So a matter of getting buy-in from the strip mall to make that happen and make that alleyway car-free, which now it has a lot of cars in it. So these are some of the issues, but perhaps the most exciting, I mean, they're all exciting visions for the neighborhood, but this neighborhood was essentially built out in the early 1900s, because in 1901 there were hot mineral springs discovered after people were drilling for oil in our neighborhood, and they didn't find oil, they found hot mineral springs 2,000 feet underneath our street. And from there, the very famous, world famous Bimini Baths were developed on this block. And so people came from all over the world to soak in these hot mineral baths. So they were therapeutic, also recreational. There was an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and people trained for the Olympics here. And it was a totally a pedestrian and transit-oriented neighborhood. So essentially, we had the end of one of our streetcar lines that ended here and brought people from around the city to the baths. So the baths closed down in 1951. We know they're still down there and probably very accessible and clean, because we have a very high water table that's probably very polluted, the water table that's 20 feet down, but 2,000 feet down, probably still pretty clean. So we want to bring back the baths and demonstrate geothermal heating and cooling in the neighborhood, as well as recreational and therapeutic uses of the baths, make it a mixed use development, so that on the ground floor would be the baths. Maybe the swimming pool would be in the middle of the street, we don't know. And then maybe have a second floor where all the healing arts are practiced, massage therapy, herbal remedies, and chiropractor, and all the different healing arts, the Chinese medicine, acupuncture. And then on the upper floors, we would have affordable housing so that the healing arts people could have low housing costs and therefore make their services much more affordable to the working class people that live in our neighborhood, or will at some point, hopefully, still hopefully. So that's the vision for that. And we believe that what we will do is we will partner on that project with our municipal utility and water agency. Because they'll want to demonstrate also the geothermal heating and cooling here in this neighborhood as a new source of energy, because we do have hot mineral springs underneath much of LA down below. Mm-hmm. So I hope to work on that a little bit this year.
One other thing I want to ask about is, or have you say a little bit about the neighborhood council vote coming up, and why are you promoting this so heavily? Why is this important to you?
Well, Los Angeles has 99 neighborhood councils. I think in order to be a neighborhood council, you have to have a minimum population of about 25,000 in your boundary. And I think that, I'm not positive of that, but something like that. And every neighborhood council has to be certified by the city of Los Angeles. It is a And the elections are public elections by people who live and or work and are or otherwise associated within the boundaries of the neighborhood council. So in our case, quite frankly, there's some sentimental value to it. The when one of our councilmen back in the 25, 30 years ago was first talking about neighborhood councils. I think one of the very first organizing meetings was held in this building long before we owned it, in the lobby in our big building. And I was intrigued with the idea of local democracy, as local as you can get other than just being a nonprofit organization and or community neighborhood association. And so I followed it from the very, very beginning and helped to bring it into existence. One way or another, the whole neighborhood council movement was an advocate for it, and then have been a stakeholder within our own neighborhood council since its inception. And so I feel we've had two eco villagers sit on the neighborhood council at various times in its history, but none right now. Now we have two eco villagers running for the neighborhood council election. And incidentally, one of the wonderful things about our neighborhood council election in LA is anyone that's eligible by being a resident or work and so forth can vote, even if you are undocumented. And so we have many, many people in our neighborhood that are undocumented. And so getting word out to them that they can vote, and when you tell them that, oh, they're really excited to do that. So I think it's really important to get out the vote. And I do think we have a strong presence in the neighborhood council because a few of us have regularly attended meetings over the past 10, 12 years since it was certified. And so we're well known. We speak up at every, even I'm not on the board and choose not to be, but I speak up at every meeting, and we are a well known by other stakeholders in the neighborhood council. And because of that we have this really terrific reputation for being present and speaking up for things that are important to our neighborhood. I believe that if we had strong leadership from LA Eco Village on the neighborhood council, we could get a lot more environmentally sensitive concepts manifested in our area. Now, the more people that we can get to come out and vote, the stronger is our voice in city with our council person and in City Hall. So that's why I feel quite strongly about it. And whether we're talking about reducing auto dependency in the neighborhood, increasing bicycle infrastructure, getting more sustainable energy manifested in the area, getting better recycling or buying less stuff kinds of things. There's so many things as leadership that we could maybe blow our horns about, so to speak. And so that's why I feel strongly about it.